Okay, let's picture a scenario for a moment. You have a major financial institution in London. Suddenly, it's implicated in this massive fraud scheme, and it stretches across, say, seven different jurisdictions, countries with completely different legal, political, and, cultural systems. Who has the map for that kind of tangled mess?
That kind of hyper-complex transnational problem is exactly what we're diving into today. Where finance, crime, sovereignty, and procedure all just collide. Our sources for this revolve entirely around what is basically the definitive resource for this space, the International Enforcement Law Reporter, or the ILR, as it's known.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Our mission for you listening is to get a quick authoritative handle on this really critical field. We want to move past the marketing language and figure out why. Why is the ILR considered, the foremost source on international criminal and enforcement law? We need to get at the fundamental mechanisms, the substantive and procedural aspects that underpin all of this.
And that distinction is just. It's absolutely crucial in an international context. Substantive law that dictates what the actual crime is. Is bribery defined the same way in country A as it is in country B? Probably not. But then procedural law defines the practical steps. How do we request evidence from a foreign government? How do you actually extradite a high-value suspect to stand trial? The ILR, it really aims to cover both sides of that coin with equal authority.
And to maintain that kind of authority, you need deep roots. We know the ILR isn't some flash in the pan publication. The
Correct.
source material tells us this thing has been documenting premier developments since, when was it? September 1985.
That's right. So volume one issue I started nearly 4 decades ago.
Wow.
And that longevity, it suggests they haven't just been summarizing cases. They've been documenting the minute-by-minute evolution of global regulation itself. What's really compelling, I think, is how the ILR uses this history. It's not just looking backward at legal precedent. It identifies and analyzes current trends, in legislative, administrative, and case law developments. And that provides a critical forward-looking perspective for practitioners, for academics, for policymakers.
That forward view is key. It has to be, because international enforcement law is always dynamic. I mean, it often moves faster than formal treaties or court decisions can even keep up. I've seen specialized legal reporters, they launch quickly and then just fade out because they can't keep pace. What has the ILR done to maintain quality control across such disparate and constantly shifting subjects?
I think they focus on synthesis and utility. That's the core of it.
Yeah.
They structure their articles with these really detailed annotations, and they're designed to make the ILR useful as both a powerful historical reference tool and a practical guide for, daily international law practice. It's not just a collection of documents, it's an interpretive guide.
Right. And that interpretive approach is, it's necessary, especially when you look at the sheer scope of topics they call enforcement law. It's an incredibly vast spectrum. It covers everything from, high stakes corporate compliance to humanitarian crises.
Yeah, let's break down the subject areas just to grasp this breadth. Starting with the topics that, directly impact global commerce and regulatory compliance. We're talking about the high-stakes world of financial and economic crimes.
These are the laws that keep multinational corporations and, frankly, governments in constant motion. They dedicate serious attention to money laundering, securities enforcement, and white-collar crime. And critically, they cover the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the FCPA.
Right, and for listeners who might not be familiar with that specific term, the FCPA is it's really the cornerstone of U.S. corporate integrity law. It governs how American companies and individuals handle anti-bribery measures overseas. It's the primary legal tool the Justice Department uses when it's tackling transnational corruption.
And they also couple that with these incredibly specialized topics like asset forfeiture, which is a crucial concept in global crime fighting. It's the legal process where governments seize property, cash, real estate, cars, whatever was derived from or used in illegal activities. It sounds kind of bureaucratic, but a lot of the time, the recovery of those assets is the main goal in these big drug trafficking or white-collar cases.
Exactly. Then you transition to topics covering modern justice and serious transnational crime. They cover cybercrime and intellectual property law, which are absolutely essential today alongside the whole administration of justice.
But I have to admit, the scope is, it's almost unbelievable. How can one publication credibly track all of that and also cover the complexities of war crimes and genocide? I mean, aren't those two completely distinct legal worlds? Aren't they driven by totally different political philosophies?
That's a great question. And it gets to their methodology. The difference between tracking FCPA and tracking genocide lies in the underlying mechanisms. The ILR connects the dots, by focusing on the legal movement. See, whether the underlying crime is financial fraud or a human rights violation, the procedure involves the movement of evidence, the transfer of suspects, the application of international agreements. The methodology of enforcement is what ties it all together.
Ah, okay. And none of that enforcement can happen without the organizational mechanisms in place. And the ILR also dedicates significant space to these structures, things like extradition and prisoner transfer, the functioning of international courts and tribunals, the application of EU and UN law, and of course, the pivotal coordinating role of Interpol. It's a holistic view of the whole global law and order ecosystem.
And here's where we find the most surprising nugget of insight. The thing that truly sets this publication apart from standard legal reporters. The ILR focuses heavily on material that hasn't even reached case or treaty law yet.
Okay, so if they aren't just reporting on the big convictions or the signed treaties, what are they tracking?
They report on subtle policy movements, the administrative and executive decisions that signal a shift in government priorities. Think about tracking things like executive decisions on training programs or resource allocation for appropriations. This is the difference between reading the headlines and reading the tea leaves.
That's fascinating. So they are effectively reporting on the machinery of enforcement before it creates a major legal conflict. So, for instance, if the Department of Justice is suddenly funding specialized training for investigators on, say, dark web crypto seizures, the ILR would report that policy shift 6 months before the first big prosecution even hits the news. That kind of foresight must save practitioners countless hours, lets them adjust compliance programs proactively.
It's a huge advantage. And that level of detail, it requires serious, unwavering intellectual oversight. The credibility of any resource rests heavily on its contributors. So let's look at the person who's provided that consistent stability for nearly four decades. Bruce Zagaras, the editor and founder.
Right. Mr. Zagaras is deeply embedded in both the active practice and the academic side of this field. He's a partner at Berliner, Corcoran, and Rowe, LLP in D.C., and his practice specializes exclusively in international enforcement matters. He's not reviewing cases from an ivory tower. He is fighting them in real time.
Exactly. And his influence is just as significant in the academic sphere. He's active in the American Bar Association. He's taught at numerous U.S. law schools. It's that blend. Being both an active practitioner and a major academic figure, that really underscores the ILR's authority.
And you can gauge his authority directly through his published works. They aren't just footnotes, they are core texts. For example, he authored International White-Collar Crime, Cases and Materials. The second edition came out in 2015.
And the fact that this book is used in law schools, it shows that he is defining how the next generation understands core issues. You know, things like sanctions, transnational fraud, FCPA compliance. It makes the IGLR a dynamic learning tool, not just some static reference manual.
And he also co-authored International Criminal Law. And that deals with the immense procedural complexities around global organized crime, drug trafficking, war crimes, the difficult process of securing evidence from countries with judicial systems that are completely alien to ours.
And this editorial oversight is crucial. It ensures the analysis of enforcement methodology like extradition, mutual legal assistance, is consistent and authoritative. It doesn't matter if the underlying crime is financial or humanitarian. The insights aren't theoretical. They are grounded in decades of real-world engagement.
That institutional knowledge is incredibly valuable, which brings us to, okay, how does one actually access this high-value specialized information? They offer a standard subscription, but the most important feature seems to be this optional IGLR premium add-on.
Yes. For a relatively small amount extra per year, subscribers get access to the premium archives. That's every single article published since Volume 1, Issue I, in 1985. We're talking about nearly four decades of documented global enforcement history right at your fingertips.
And the key isn't just the sheer volume of it, it's the utility. The archives come with a powerful search engine. You can quickly retrieve articles not just by date, but by thematic area or geographical location.
Exactly. So if you need to trace how international tax enforcement has evolved specifically within the European Union over the last decade, you can pinpoint that information quickly. Gives you context and background that you just can't find through general news searches.
And the premium add-on also includes an electronic newsletter. So that's a weekly email update keeping you current on the very latest developments. And you get to read articles from upcoming issues before they're officially published. That's a significant information edge in a field that moves so quickly.
It really is. And for even faster news, the ILR maintains a blog for rapid updates on international enforcement matters. So they ensure subscribers have every angle covered.
So if this analysis has piqued your interest, the ILR makes it pretty easy to sample the resource. They invite new users to experience the content free for 2 months to really test its utility for your specific needs.
Right, and if you decide to subscribe after that sample period, they offer a special discounted rate significantly lower than the standard price. The details for this offer, including how to follow up by phone or email, you can easily find them on their website, www.ilr.com.
So what does this all mean? It means you have a direct path, not just to reading the law, but to understanding the complex machinery of international enforcement, the stuff that underpins global security and commerce, all guided by a recognized expert in the field who is actively shaping the policy landscape.
And gaining this specialized knowledge quickly is. It's essential for navigating this complex and constantly shifting landscape of international law and policy. The IEL's value proposition is clear. Comprehensive, annotated, and forward-looking coverage that connects, you know, high finance and human rights through consistent legal analysis.
Our sources indicate the ILR focuses really heavily on U.S. extradition treaties and mutual legal assistance in criminal matters.
Yeah, and given the vast array of global crimes covered from organized drug trafficking to complex cybercrime and even war crimes, just consider the immense logistical and legal challenge there. What does it truly take? In terms of political will, complex negotiations, and shared legal infrastructure. For dozens of sovereign nations, often with conflicting domestic laws, to agree on the definition and enforcement of a single legal concept, like money laundering or extradition. That coordination nightmare, that massive challenge of harmonizing global justice. That's the deeper dive we've only just begun to sample.